I want to welcome everyone. My name is Miriam Schulman. I'm the Assistant Director of the Ethics Center. And today's program is Conscience, Edward Snowden, and the Internet. Has civil disobedience gone too far? Before I introduce our panelists, I want to point out that this program is one of several that are part of our Conscience Project. You can find this brochure out on the tables outside. The next speaker in that series will be Darcia Narvaez, who is going to be talking about fostering conscience and moral character through classroom teaching. And this series is underwritten in part by a gift from Phyllis and Mike Shea. So now to our panelists, who many of you recognize. They're both staff at the Ethics Center. We have David DeCoste, who is the Director of Campus Ethics Programs and also a lecturer in religious studies. And we have Irina Raiku, who is the Director of Internet Programs at the Ethics Center. She is a lawyer, graduate of SCU, and a certified information privacy professional. And with that very short introduction, I'm going to let them take it away.
Okay, thank you, Miriam. And I have to say, it's a real pleasure to be doing this event, in part because I usually host these things, and that means I do not have to wear a tie today, which is, for me, totally awesome. So what we wanted to do was talk for about 15, at most max 20 each, and then really open it up for Q&A and conversation, and really view this entire event as sort of a way to allow questions to surface in our community about these really important matters. I am not a tech guy nor a lawyer. I'm an ethicist interested in this particularly through the lens of conscience and civil disobedience, and that's my sort of point of entry into the topic. Also, the topic kind of came up for us really last summer in conversations with Irina, hallway conversations, where we had differing takes on Edward Snowden and what he had done, and you'll hear more about it today. But I think in ways, fair to say, I was more critical of him. Irina was more bullish on what he had done, and that kind of got us thinking about why and what was the source of the difference. And then also, it got us talking a bit about whether Snowden could be understood or seen in line with other people like Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks crowd, Chelsea Manning, Aaron Swartz, and others. And it's my take that I think he can be. I think he is different from them, and I actually appreciate what Snowden has done more than what those folks have done. But I think he still can be understood in light of them, and all of them in some ways, as folks advancing what tech writer Dana Boyd has sort of talked about. She has said that leaking information is going to be the civil disobedience of our age. And I think that's the phenomenon we wanted to kind of capture and raise, particularly in light of Snowden, in our conversation today. So I thought I'd first talk about kind of what bothered me about Snowden and others, and then kind of talk a little more about my reading of some of the work of Snowden, and then put those thoughts in light of some kind of classical conversations or examples of civil disobedience in American history, and kind of see what light they shed on particularly the actions of Snowden. So I want to be clear, too. I do not at all share the view that I've read a bit about and people attributing, imputing to Snowden and others that he's arrogant, that he's destined to be an alcoholic or other kinds of really, to my mind, just ridiculous, preposterous ideas. And beyond that, to call him a traitor, I think, is ridiculous as well. So, in any case, some of my my misgivings. I find, both in Snowden and others, there's a very polarized appeal to values. There's not much in the middle. It's kind of a sense of the individual versus big systems, corporate or governmental. There's a polarization that's reflected in the sense of internet freedom versus power, in the sense of transparency versus secrecy. They are very, in Snowden 2, the appeals are often almost entirely procedural. It's how to enhance conversation, how to have better decision making. It's never really very substantive in terms of the kinds of values that these folks are talking about. It's also, I was bothered by the release of the massive amounts of data instead of something much more targeted. I was bothered by his bypassing established institutions of review, like Senate committees, intelligence committees. And I thought my misgivings were really very well captured, even shaped a bit, by an excellent column from by New York Times columnist David Brooks last June, just fairly recently after the leaks, where Brooks said, and this is speaking of Snowden, "If you live a life unshaped by the mediating institutions of civil society, perhaps it makes sense to see the world a certain way. Life is not embedded in a series of gently gradated authoritative structures: family, neighborhood, religious group, state, nation, and world. Instead, it's just the solitary, naked individual in the gigantic, menacing state. This lens makes you more likely to share the distinct strands of libertarianism that are blossoming in this fragmenting age: the deep suspicion of authority, the strong belief that hierarchies and organizations are suspect, the fervent devotion to transparency, the assumption that individual preference should be supreme." Okay, I want to then talk about a little in my reading of some of the writing by Snowden, Aaron Swartz, Bradley Manning, Julian Assange, some of the key, or if not the key, ideas that came to me that seemed to be motivating them. First of all, the judgment that information is power. And that's, to me, very interesting. So we've got many different modes of power: money, weapons, human capital, the truth. And for them, information really has pride of place among these different kind of levers of power in the contemporary world. Another dimension, I think, of their thinking that's crucial is that holding information privately or secretly necessarily introduces great imbalances of power and thus is a great threat. So secrecy becomes a kind of code word for necessarily unjust. And let me see. So conversely here, the antidote to that problem of secrecy of information is what they call the phrase information freedom. That seems to be those words, that phrase is really crucial. And this, as one other tech writer put it, is really the value of our age: information freedom. So what does information freedom mean? I kind of was looking at that more closely. And so far as I can tell, it appears to mean, in effect, freeing information from unjust confines of secrecy. So the emphasis of all of these folks is very much on prying loose information, or in the word they use, sharing information, getting it out from behind these corporate or governmental kind of walls of secrecy. But the emphasis is really on the prying, the get it out. And again, it's kind of procedural. There's not really an emphasis on what the release, the prying, the sharing of information is for. It's just getting it out. That's the real value, it seems to me. And this is Aaron Swartz, tragically young man who killed himself, who was very strongly wanting to release a lot of scholarship that he felt was unjustly held by corporations and the like. So he was quoted as saying, or he wrote, I'm sorry, in a manifesto, "We need to take information wherever it is stored, make our copies, and share them with the world. We need to take stuff that's out of copyright and add it to the archive. We need to buy secret databases and put them on the web. We need to download scientific journals and upload them to file-sharing networks. We need to fight for guerrilla open access." So again, the emphasis always on freeing, getting it loose, but again, the substantive element there to me is missing. What's this for? I think another element that's sort of missing to my mind from this is just thinking about, it's all about information. It is not about wisdom. It is not about the kind of organization of information. It's about chunks of data and getting them out there. Okay, I think another emphasis of the group on procedural matters is manifested especially in what Snowden had to say, and I think to my mind the most convincing, and they are very convincing, arguments he's had justifying what he's done are the appeals really to procedural democracy that he makes. That there was clearly some, you know, subversion of process here in really in very significant ways about programs morphing and being created and reappearing in guises that no one had more publicly authorized earlier on. Snowden, as he said, the more you're told it's not a problem until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public and not by somebody who is simply hired by the government. Snowden also, as motives for what he did, made a number of arguments, talking about the government seeking total awareness, his word, not wanting to live in a world without where every thought he had, every idea would be able to be monitored by the government. Not wanting the government to destroy privacy, internet freedom, and basic liberties, and arguing that the whole phone metadata program of the NSA amounted to a general warrant, that the NSA, in effect, had a general warrant for the entire country's metadata. So, Snowden, Manning, Aaron Swartz, others, all really very specifically use the language of conscience in appealing to justify what they're doing. I do find that beyond the language of conscience, the kind of values they appeal to are largely, if not exclusively, procedural. Some misgivings of my own, and then like to move into a number of misgivings drawn from looking at other examples of civil disobedience. I mentioned before, first of all, misgiving about the theft of just massive amounts of data. I don't understand exactly why it could not have been something much more targeted. This seems to me consistent with this emphasis on freeing information, getting it out, with less emphasis on a sense of wisdom. What exactly are we freeing it for? I also think, in terms of that sense, there is, I think, you know, Snowden has a recent article last week in the New Republic by Sean Willens, historian at Princeton, kind of chronicled in looking at some past writings of Snowden, you know, very strongly libertarian leanings that he has. I think those are really consistent with this notion of freeing information. We're going to now decide it. In effect, it seems to me he's assuming sort of town hall formats where we're going to muse about how we figure out the next thing. I think there's really an inaccurate sense of the nature of politics that he has, and the sense that politics always involves some sorts of compromises, some kinds of secrecy and the like, and that is a difficulty I have with his notions of transparency. Okay. So turning to a few examples from the past, I really enjoyed having a chance to look at some of these again. I thought Henry David Thoreau's Letter on Civil Disobedience, probably familiar to many of us from different times in our schooling. And of the ones that I looked at, this was really interesting to me because I thought it was most kind of in tune with where Snowden was at. Thoreau having, in some ways to me, an even more critical view of government than Snowden has. Also, Thoreau writing 1849 at a time where there's sort of, you know, an inchoate building, great national division that's taking root, battling over the Mexican War, battling over slavery, and Thoreau is kind of in the thick of all of that and sharing with that this sense of a very critical view of the government. But Thoreau also has a much richer sense of substantive justice, I think, than Snowden. And at one point in the letter, Thoreau's letter, he's considering an argument by another philosopher on when one might be permitted to disagree with the government, and the philosopher's arguing in more utilitarian terms, kind of cost-benefit. And Thoreau just rejects that and saying there are certain things that you just must do. And so he says here, and you must do them, anyone who would save his life in such a case shall lose it. And he notes that this people must cease to hold slaves and to make war on Mexico, though it cost them their existence as a people. And he's really saying there that one must act in a way in such a situation as he was facing to try to compel the nation, persuade the nation to cease to hold slaves or make war, and the cost of doing that could be the existence of the American people, but that decision couldn't be kind of made by a cost-benefit analysis. And that's interesting because I think Snowden, in some ways, when you read him, there's sort of a, he notes, an engineering, iterative perspective on his decision-making that in a way sounds in the end very much like a cost-benefit analysis that's missing some deeper substantive appeal. Okay, Martin Luther King and Letter from Birmingham Jail. It's very interesting noting the kind of steps that King advocated, all he and his all of his fellow people in those demonstrations were to follow. Step number two of the process of getting to direct action is negotiation. And it's very striking to see, I mean, King and others being willing to negotiate with the leaders of the government of Birmingham at that time, despite all the terrible things that were being done to African Americans. And that just really, in a sense, also confirms for me, I think Snowden should have done much more. He could have talked to Feinstein, Rogers, Rand Paul, Ron Wyden, and it's not clear to me, really, or persuasive that he did not. Also, it's very striking reading King, the clearly substantive nature of King's appeal to civil disobedience and to conscience, both an appeal to the Christian tradition and appeal very clearly philosophically and philosophical and psychological sense to the notion that unjust laws degrade human personality. And lastly, with King, I think there's the clear sense in the process of civil disobedience that the end of the process is that the one who acts with such disobedience indeed submits to the punishment of the law as a way to reaffirm respect for the law, and in that sense to reaffirm the political community. And that is something I think is a real, to my mind, misgiving about what Snowden's doing right now. And lastly, and wanted to note John Courtney Murray, the great Jesuit theologian, writing on selective conscientious objection during the Civil Vietnam War. Murray affirmed it in principle. And he appeals here in many ways to the Crito and Plato by saying that the conscience of the one dissenting, Snowden and others, may not indeed be resigned to the state, but the state also has its own conscience, what Murray calls the conscience of the laws. Thus, the burden is on the one dissenting, but the dissenter always remains within the political community. And if we misjudge that, we lose the true nature of the tension, the moral tension that's at stake. Otherwise, the struggle devolves into one between random individuals and arbitrary authority. And I think that final way of putting it is the way I think about Snowden and others of the information freedom crowd. Too often, they tilt into this scenario where it is the random set of individuals versus necessarily arbitrary authority. And to my mind, that is a false dichotomy. I think it's much more accurately understood as individuals acting within a political community. In that sense, having the obligations and conscience they've exercised, Snowden, I think, indeed, to the benefit of us all, but nevertheless having obligations that continue to exist to the political community and needing to see those through as part of what it means to act in civil disobedience. So I'll conclude my remarks there and turn it over to Arena.
Thank you, and please let me know if you can't hear me. I've been shocked to find out that sometimes I'm not as loud as I think I am. So let me start by saying that I had a hard time even thinking about Aaron Swartz in the same context as the other three, because I think their contexts are so different in terms of, you know, national security versus the kind of things that he was dealing with. I don't see the similarities between these cases as being as significant as the differences between them. So where David sees sort of some underlying tensions, I really think the cases are so different that we have to take them one by one. And I would almost leave Aaron out of that one. I should add that I'm only bullish on Snowden. I'm not on WikiLeaks and Assange and Manning or Anonymous. I think that Snowden did all of us an immense favor, but not because I think all information should be free or that there should be no secrecy in terms of national security or anything like that. And I think at the same time, I really do understand the concern that we are now allowing, and because of the way the internet is now changing our lives, we have individuals who have the power to do something like what Snowden did. That is scary, that really they can circumvent and in the name of their own personal conscience can go ahead and subvert these systems that have been set up by our society. So I should also tell you a little bit about me, just to clarify some of where I'm coming from. I grew up in Romania when it was communist. And when there was general surveillance, I was a kid when I came here, but even kids had the sense that that was not a good way to live with somebody. And it wasn't even clear. I mean, at the time, they didn't have the abilities that we have now, right? They couldn't listen to every phone. But I remember people, when they wanted to tell an anti-government joke, picking up, you know, the rotary phone handset and covering the mouthpiece. And that's how you lived. So inherently, I'm really concerned by the notion that any government, then of course the American government is entirely different, but that any government would have that kind of, and I think any government would have that effect on people who feel themselves surveilled at that level. I'm also an attorney, and for most of the attorneys that I know, the notion of secret opinions issued by a secret court where only one side is heard, in other words, the government, where the judges are all appointed by one person, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. These are all notions that are very troubling to most of the attorneys that I know. That's not how we're trained. Truth comes out. And it becomes, when we're talking about systems, that setting up that kind of system just invites trouble. When Snowden talked about total information awareness, he wasn't coming up with that term. That was a term that had been proposed by the government for a program that was initially proposed, I don't remember what year, but I think it was under President Bush. And they wanted to call it total information awareness. People got really concerned about that, so they said, no, no, it's terrorist information awareness. We just changed what the T meant, and now it was okay, right? But the program was going to stay the same. That didn't fly, and then we still ended up with something kind of like it. So I was interested, and I found a comment by Jeffrey Stone. Jeffrey Stone is a University of Chicago law professor, and he was a member of the five-person panel appointed by the White House in response to Snowden's revelations. And when that panel was appointed, privacy advocates kind of freaked out, and they said, these are all insiders, and they're just going to spew to party line. And, of course, the panel came out and made recommended 46 different changes to what we have in place right now. Anyway, Jeffrey Stone, so one of the five panelists, was asked, when pressed about Snowden's less than viable alternative to go through the chain of command rather than the media, Stone said that that way might not have done anything, but that wasn't Stone's choice to make on behalf of all Americans. Quote, I don't want the individual government employee to make the judgment for themselves of what's best for the U.S., Stone said. I just don't trust that. The article continued, Stone and the other four members of the NSA review panel unanimously agreed on all 46 of its recommendations to Obama. The recommendations include the bolstering of protections for whistleblowers in the intelligence community. So at the same time that he's saying we don't want individuals just spilling the beans, he's saying we need to allow individuals, i.e. whistleblowers, to come forward and have an impact on the system when they think that something is going wrong. And right now, I think, particularly in the case of Snowden, there are a lot of sort of factual gaps in what we know. And one of those gaps, I hear this over and over again, is why didn't he go through the proper channels? The proper channels did not exist and still don't exist. There is no whistleblower protection for contractors like him. He could not go to his senator or any other people in Congress because of the security clearance that you have to have in order to share that information. Even if he had, basically then he would have been putting them in a position where they would have to break the law. Because even the ones of them who had the clearance had been sort of waving, saying, we can't tell you what's going on, but something really bad is going on and you should be concerned, but we can't tell you. So going to them was not really going to change things. We should be concerned about people just being able to take matters into their own hands and put out information that can endanger everybody in some way. But we need to allow people like him, who actually know more than the rest of us, to have a stronger voice in what's going on. And I have a list of links. Everything I'm saying, I have links to readings that will argue, and I realize that there are two sides to this. But if you're interested in any of the points that I'm making, please fire me an email afterwards, and I will send you a document with links to articles that detail all of these things. Why he couldn't go to Congress. Why he didn't just happen to go to Russia because, he must not really care about Friedman, or why would he go there? I mean, these are points that get made over and over again, and somehow we don't seem to move past them. In terms of his character or his political leanings, if he's a libertarian or not, I thought we should talk maybe a little bit about a burglary that happened in 1971. This was a burglary that led to the Church Commission that tried to put a stop to some of these activities. But it was eight people who literally, not over the internet, just broke into the FBI offices and stole documents and then released them to the media. Since then, they've been hailed as heroes, whistleblowers, people who acted in, justified civil disobedience. They were three women and five men of various religious backgrounds, ages 20 to 44. One of them was a religion professor at Temple University, former Methodist pastor, and son of the prominent bishop in Indianapolis. Do we feel better about his moral character and his right to do this than we do about Snowden, who maybe said all kinds of things we would disagree with? I think that's irrelevant. I think whether we like the person who did this or not is not the point. And part of the conversation that David and I had started to have is because I was getting really frustrated when Snowden first started releasing his information, that immediately the media coverage was, is he a whistleblower or not? Is he a traitor or a hero? And I kept thinking, look at what he's saying is happening. I don't care how we characterize them. We can talk about that later. And I think we were both glad we wanted to have this event, and we put it off intentionally for quite a while because we knew that information would keep coming out and that we didn't know enough. And I still think we don't know enough. Part of what's shocking to me about everything that happens about Snowden is we still don't know a lot. A lot of what we're saying are sort of guesses or hints based on some information we've gotten, incomplete information. And that threatens democracy. And you can argue that democracy is just a procedural thing too, right? That it's not substantive, it's procedural. But we think of that as being pretty important. And I found another quote that I thought was really powerful. This was written in 2004 about the Patriot Act in general. The Patriot Act inverts the constitutional requirement that people's lives be private and the work of government officials be public. It instead crafts a set of conditions in which our inner lives become transparent and the workings of the government become opaque. Either one of these outcomes would imperil democracy. Together, they not only injure the country, but also cut off the avenues of repair. And that's the concern here, right? It's not that we don't care about secrecy, but we would prefer that secrecy be reserved for the individuals rather than the government. And again, these are all generalizations. To talk about secrecy in general, of course everybody understands that we need some secrecy in the area of national security, that we don't need any kind of information that would endanger people on the ground, that we don't need the specifics about programs, but the secrecy that we have now is untenable. And forgive me for, I keep reading your quotes, but I will read you one more long one. This is from a 2009 FISA court opinion, so the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act opinion, court. This was declassified only after Snowden's revelation. The reason we even know what this court decided is because he came out and then suddenly some opinions that until then had been deemed too secret to be released now were okay to release. So this is from 2009. The court that was supposed to provide the oversight that we also keep hearing about. On December 12, 2008, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court reauthorized the government to acquire telephone metadata documents. Because the collection will result in NSA collecting called detailed records pertaining to communications of United States persons located within the U.S. who are not the subject of any FBI investigation and whose metadata could not otherwise be legally captured in bulk, the government proposed strict minimization procedures, the government proposed them, that strictly control the acquisition, accessing, dissemination, and retention of these records by the NSA and the FBI. The court's primary order directed the government to strictly adhere to these procedures as required by statute. The opinion then describes the ways in which the government failed to comply with those procedures. Quote, the government has compounded its noncompliance with the court's orders by repeatedly submitting inaccurate descriptions of the process to the court. And as noted below, the NSA continues to uncover examples of systemic noncompliance. In summary, since January 15, 2009, it has finally come to light that the court's authorization of this vast collection program have been premised on a flawed description of how the NSA uses business records metadata. This misperception by the court existed from the inception of its authorized collection in May 2006, buttressed by repeated inaccurate statements made in the government submissions, and despite a government-devised and court-mandated oversight regime. The minimization procedures proposed by the government in each successive application and approved and adopted as binding by the orders of the court have been so frequently and systematically violated that it can fairly be said that this critical element of the overall business records regime has never functioned effectively. That was in 2009. I suspect that most of you don't read FISA court opinions. I do, but you probably didn't get that quote, right? Nobody could read them until after Snowden. And so now, I mean, this is what I'm talking about, a level of secrecy that becomes corrosive. That even when a court that is supposed to provide the oversight says nothing's been working for years, we don't know. So how are we supposed to change anything? How are we supposed to make any kind of improvements in the absence of information? Not all information should be free. But this information, which somehow after his revelations was deemed to be okay to give to us, should have been given to us much earlier. And then, again, most of you probably don't read. You hear that there have been 12 instances of intentional abuse. Well, actually, the way it came out was this. The people who were supposed to provide oversight initially said there have been no abuses of the programs. Then they said, we have no evidence of abuses of the programs. Then they said, there have been no intentional abuses of the programs. Then they said there have been very few cases of intentional abuses. Then they said, compared to the vast numbers involved, there have been very few intentional abuses. And now the bar is down to not just, I mean, the court said there were systemic abuses, but now we're at, there have been no systemic abuses that were not eventually corrected. That's the most recent way I heard it phrased. When they say there have been very few intentional abuses, usually they refer to a letter in which they were responding to Senator Grassley, and they said, you must have heard about Lovent. Have you heard about Lovent? Love-int is, as opposed to SIG and signal intelligence, love-int is when certain NSA analysts were spying on their loved ones. Foreign nationals, so it's okay. But they actually had a name for it. It was love-int. And so in response to Senator Grassley, he got a letter that said, and this is from the Inspector General of the NSA, who wrote, since January 2003, there have been 12 substantiated instances of intentional misuse of the signal intelligence. 12, you figured, over all these years is not that dramatic. And the number I had always heard, and I'm the one who's reading everything, and it's very interesting, was this 12. Well, when you read the letter itself, it turns out that many of them had queried, you know, more than one per person. One of them had queried 9 different numbers over the course of 5 years and was not caught over the course of 5 years that he was doing this, which was totally illegally and intentionally abusive. And then my favorite one, which I only noticed today, said, in 2009, a military unit at a foreign location notified the NSA OIG that in 2009, a military member had queried a country's phone numbers, to aid in learning that country's language. All of the phone numbers of a particular country counts as one of the 12 instances. There were 12 people who did this. So this is kind of how the information has been coming out. It doesn't generate a lot of trust in what's going on and whether we'll be able to make appropriate changes. And again, this is not to take away the concern about individuals who just decide to take matters in their own hands. I happen to think that in his particular case, knowing everything I know, he did follow these criteria, except for the last two. And David and I don't necessarily agree on all of these criteria, and we would probably prioritize them differently. But we were trying to think, well, what makes it, if we don't care, you know, people say, well, he's not a whistleblower if the conduct is, you know, that he blew the whistle about is not illegal. And then we can argue, and we don't know yet that the programs that were legal or not. But that's a question of definition. And what we really wanted to get at is, if somebody does decide to take this drastic step, are they doing the right thing? Was this the right thing to do? So we tried to come up with some criteria, like how do you determine? And some of them are not here. I was thinking about this. The center where I work, the Markle Center, long before I came there, a lot of really good people put together a framework for ethical decision making. And this is an ethical decision that you take if you're an individual and you decide to do something like civil disobedience. And the two steps that are missing here, the first one is you have to consider all the stakeholders and you have to make sure that you know all the facts. And I think that in his case, yes, he was very well informed. And he knew that there were no channels to go through. And he tried to minimize the harm. And we can debate this. And I think some of the others didn't, right? And I wouldn't do it. For example, in the case of Aaron Schwartz, I think the issues he was addressing were powerful. But to me, they don't justify the step he took. I think in Snowden's case, the magnitude of the problem was such and the significance of what he was revealing was such that it did justify it. I would save it for only the most severe of problems, right? At what point do you decide that you, your conscience or your knowledge or whatever it is about you means that you can take things in your own hand only if it's something extremely significant and only if you really try to minimize the harm and do all of those things behind me. And I'll just then, because I really do want to sort of hash it out, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, nobody has any strong feelings about any of this stuff, right? So I wanted to end with one quote from a writer writing in Slate magazine and who is an engineer and who said he's interviewed hundreds of people like Snowden. And he writes, in past generations, people like Snowden, members of a non-elite middle class, would have settled down into staid white-collar jobs that didn't make full use of their intellect, probably close to where they grew up. The tech and internet boom of the last 20 years has given them opportunities to learn and explore outside of traditional forms of higher education, to travel and to meet others who share their worldview. It has also given them more power. There's no smoking gun for what made Snowden leak classified information. At least until recently, he was simply too typical of his kind. If you put enough intelligent, independent, anti-authoritarian people in positions of relative power, at a time when government and enterprise are perceived to have lost moral authority and contravened the individualist ideas they purport to defend, you will sooner or later produce a Snowden. Many more like him will be paying close attention to his fate. So I think we do live in a world that's going to produce more of them, and I think that's why it becomes extremely important to talk about when is it justified to do this, what constitutes civil disobedience as opposed to you just being arrogant and thinking you know better, and to provide those channels for whistleblowers that will allow them to work within the system so we can all have some input into what they think is the right thing to do.
So we really can see this. Invite all your questions and comments. Oh, Mike.
Well, David and Irina, thank you very much. David, I came in a little bit late, so I'm sure you made all your good points before I came in. But I have a question for you, and it's related to Snowden. First of all, I'd say that Snowden's not Thoreau or King. Can't be held against him. We're here to make the good arguments on his behalf that he lacks the status of King and he can stand up, but shouldn't be held against him. I would suggest that it's worse than the subversion of the process. What we are facing is a possible end of democracy as we know it. When one branch has the power to spy on the other branches, they can really control the government. Now, this is an argument that actually has come from Daniel Ellsberg. And there's an op-doc at the New York Times that makes this point quite nicely. And so if Snowden is not a paradigmatic case of civil disobedience, as I think you make at the end here when you talk about him not accepting the punishment of the law, I'm one of these people who put together the framework that was mentioned before. And it seems to me that in the end what you've got is his act still has the moral authority that's akin to the Boston Tea Party, eco-sabotage, the Underground Railroad. It's morally responsible lawbreaking. So whether or not it fits the paradigmatic case of civil disobedience really isn't the main point. It's morally responsible lawbreaking. That's what you've got, and it's a great case of it.
Well, Mike, I wasn't trying to say he's not Thoreau and not King as much as to use those examples to illuminate things that I think, to me, are the misgivings I have about what he's done. So in the case of Thoreau, to my mind, for instance, Snowden, leaking information, I mean, the great value of privacy in these matters. I wish in some ways, reading Thoreau, I thought, wow, what if Snowden had done this because he was so opposed to our nation being at war for the last, 12 years now? And I just thought to myself, that would appeal to me more as a kind of basis justification for civil disobedience. And that view on his part of a larger substantive vision of the political community being so impaired by being at war together, and that's what's driving the NSA to keep doing these things. So I was appealing to those examples to sort of get at, why do I find him appealing, but only so much so appealing? And that was my reason for appealing to them. Ellen.
I'd like to raise the issue of go through the proper channels first and to amplify something that Irina said that it really wasn't.
Can you move over, please?
Talking about going through proper channels first, I'd like to amplify something that Irina said.
Hold it closer, Ellen.
I'd like to amplify what Irina said regarding that it really wasn't a channel to the congressperson. Anyone who has tried to communicate the congressperson generally hits a brick wall. There's a tremendous bureaucratic staff that protects that congressperson, and you end up sending emails and get back form emails. So I don't think that was a reasonable option. However, there was another option, and that was to talk to the press. There have been at least a dozen New York Times articles on the NSA and the Secret Court from anonymous sources who couldn't reveal themselves because the information they were disclosing to classify. For some strange reason, nobody hits on the New York Times, tries to investigate who those people are. Can you comment on that? The whole process of divulging secret information to the press, which seems to be okay, and the government doesn't go after them, versus putting it up on the internet where that guy is a traitor.
Well, he actually went to the press, Snowden did, and I suspect that to the extent that the anonymous information is coming from leakers, they probably are trying right now very hard to find out exactly who those people were, and I would direct people to the case of Thomas Drake, who was a whistleblower, who tried to blow the whistle internally, went through all the proper channels, and eventually went to the newspapers and then got prosecuted for it. The case was dismissed recently, and the judge was really angry at the government, not at Drake, and the result of that case. But it's one of the links on my little page, and it's definitely worth reading. I think you're referring to the fact that the government is also leaking information when it suits their purposes, and then those leaks are not investigated.
Surreptitiously, and it appears in the New York Times. A government official said, blah, blah, right. blah. But can't disclose that information because it's confidential information.
And it's all, I mean, when journalists disclose their sources and when they don't is a whole separate conversation that's I think is too complicated for this. I would say, though, that there had definitely been stories in the past about the court, about the NSA. In April 2012, there was a cover story in Wired magazine about this big building that's being built in Utah, and people are saying it's collecting all the phone calls. And it didn't cause a stir. It was only when Snowden put out the actual order to Verizon that said, okay, we're reauthorizing the collection of all this information for you, that I think one reason why he had to release a whole bunch of documents is that we sort of knew the story, but without any actual hard proof, without releasing documents. Even people like me, I mean, I remember hearing a security expert talk about cybersecurity, and he would talk about what Russia did, and he would talk about what China especially did, and periodically go, and of course the Americans aren't doing any of this, we're not doing any of this, and he was so sort of gleeful about it, I thought, what kind of a conspiracy theorist? Like, I just wasn't buying it, right? And it turns out, I mean, I've been thinking apologetically about him ever since, so he was absolutely right, we were doing everything, even as we were saying, and we were condemning other people and other governments were doing it, right? And that's part of the difficulty here, that now when we try to say, well, everybody's doing it, that's true, but we always said we are the representatives of internet freedom. We blamed other people who did that. We didn't say this is just the new order of the day, everybody's doing it, we need to be doing it. There's some truth to that, right? I'm not saying we should disarm ourselves, but this is why we're now in trouble, is because we always pointed the finger at others, saying that's a terrible thing that they're doing. Look how it's impacting their societies. And then it turns out we're doing it to ourselves.
Yes, please.
I have 3 points. The first would be the sense on how the information was released. I think it was responsible of Snowden to give it to a party he felt who would treat it rightly, that being Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian. In that sense, they could analyze it and look through it rather than just kind of releasing this bulk data. In fact, Glenn Greenwald says there's only been 1% released of what they have. 99% of what Snowden gave them has not been released. The second point I have is the United States is an outlier among Western democracies in declaring privacy as a fundamental right. And I think that, Ed, you mentioned you're from Romania, a lot of those European nations they're very adamant about that because they know the dangers of what can happen when a government is, you know, a total surveillance state. And then the third point I have is that how would our perspective or our view of this issue change had Snowden been a national or a government contractor of, say, North Korea, Iran, or China, and released the same sort of information? How would that change our media's and our nation's take on this kind of individual?
Well, just respond to the last question. I mean, I think I do find just the analogy saying in one breath, the United States, North Korea, China, I guess I just don't accept the kind of straight line of analogy in terms of the kind of conduct of governments in these places and the sort of controls that are possible for citizenry in each of these places. So I think there would be a different reaction to me. I wouldn't regard it as the same.
That's my point.
To your point about the Europeans, by the way, many of the European governments are doing the same thing, even as they're saying that privacy is a fundamental human right. So it's almost kind of worse. It's kind of like what I was saying before about saying you're a champion of internet freedom, and then it turns out you're not. So, you know, and they've been relying on the information provided by the U.S. So I wouldn't hold up the Europeans as examples. I think this is a worldwide problem. You know, the internet is worldwide and the surveillance is worldwide. We happen to be in a position where we are much more powerful technologically and in terms of what we can do as a country. So we have more responsibility, but others are doing it as well.
I saw it down there. Yes, please.
Hi. I was just curious. This is a very abstract question, but I was just curious that even if the infrastructure for handling whistleblowers existed, what would be the guarantee to our country that the government would still act in the interest of the American citizen? Because the problem is that the government is basically making these decisions without consulting the vast majority of people in this nation. And that's the same problem that people have had with net neutrality and the MPAA. And so would you say that a higher forum is required, a third-party forum that has no influence from the government, to ensure that promise that the government is delivering?
I'm not sure that there's anything like a forum that doesn't have some sort of influence from the government. And I don't think that there are assurances even with this path, right? I mean, we now have, you know, the leaks, and we're still waiting to see whether things will change, right? We have a lot of promise of change, but the assurance of change doesn't exist no matter what the process. I think the whistleblower protections will help sort of manage this, but it remains to be seen. It's really hard, and I was struck again by, if you're interested in the story of that burglary that I mentioned, there's a story in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's actually called The Burglary. But after those people disclosed the information, the article says the initial impact was muted. Hoover, because it was Hoover at the time, used blackmail to stifle a Justice Department call for congressional inquiry. Senator George McGovern received the documents but condemned the burglary and took no action. It was a year later when journalists started to file FOIA lawsuits and more information came out that things really built. So we're now only, what, 6-7 months into the Snowden disclosures. We don't have change yet. And some of these things build slowly, and we'll have to see what comes of it. The other thing, by the way, that I didn't mention, you know, I was thinking about what are some of the public goods that came out of the disclosure. And we mentioned, you know, that maybe we'll have a more democratic debate, and everybody's saying that the debate is really, you know, useful, even if, you know, we want to prosecute the guy who started it. But the other things are in terms of security. If nothing else, Snowden showed us that somebody like him exists, that somebody could download all those documents and we wouldn't know about it until he told us. That is a huge public service. 75% of security contractors and governmental agencies have changed their procedures in light of his disclosures. It's absolutely unbelievable to me that it took this. But we now have procedures where if somebody's working with very, very classified documents and they're trying to download them, it takes two people to make that decision. We should have had that all along. All kinds of procedures like that have changed, and not enough. But that is a huge benefit to all of us. The fact that we have these, you know, massive data collections. And by the way, we don't know how many stones have been there before him. For all we know, other people have downloaded things and blackmailed people or done who knows what, and we wouldn't have known. Yes.
Yes, please. Sorry, we have someone in the back. Yeah. There's a microphone, yeah, and we'll come back up.
Yeah. I just have one concern about the idea of, I understand that someone who engages in civil disobedience accepts the possible legal outcomes of his or her action, but I'm wondering, when considered under the light, for example, of the treatment that Saudi Arabian Manny. Manny was subject to, or in light of the information that we have about how prisoners in military facilities have been treated, isn't this an excessive burden to ask someone engaging in civil disobedience to accept? It's one thing to go to jail or to prison where you have a reasonable expectation that certain minimal guarantees of preservation of your person are going to be observed. But when we are talking of things such as Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, or Bradley Manning being literally buried alive for the time that his process, we are asking the person engaging in civil disobedience to accept cruel and unusual punishment. And I have a little bit of a problem with that. I don't know if you would comment on this.
Just in speaking empirically, don't think that going through the federal court system on Snowden's part would necessarily lead to those kind of outcomes that you're talking about. I think that's a very stark portrait of the criminal justice system in terms of matters like this. And I suppose I would acknowledge a number of the points you're making, but not make the sort of additional inferences that necessarily is going to be the fate of someone who would come back to face the kind of consequences of the law in such a matter. Moreover, though, I think, morally speaking, I think doing so, to my mind, is something that both would be more morally praiseworthy of Snowden, and I think in some ways, I think as King, or Martin Luther King and others, it's the reaffirmation of the value of law, so this law breaking is sort of to the service of law, and that itself, to me, is a very important moral value, reaffirming the political community we all live, the community in which we all sort of make our way in our lives for good or for ill. And I think those, to me, are very important things to reaffirm morally in such a case as this, even to the possibility of facing, you know, difficult circumstances in doing so.
I have more on my part.
Is there another question?
There is, right here, I know. This gentleman, yes.
This is my first visit here, and I'm a retired doctor, and I was particularly keen into the subject because I'm concerned about what's going on with our country. So the question, I have two questions really. As the gentleman spoke a little bit ago, and you answered it, I have to take, accept the legal processes that we have. I'm not an attorney, but I've talked to too many attorneys who tell me what a show it is sometimes in the courtroom. It becomes a show, and whoever puts on the best show wins the case, and the victims are not necessarily, justice does not always come through. So that's just an opinion of mine. Being a doctor, I have an opinion like that. The other thing I wanted to bring up about the whistleblower issue, how would you folks label as Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche PAC actions that they take I don't know if you folks see the signs with Barack Obama with the mustache, the hipper mustache, and the concern that the LaRouche folks have about what's going on with this country and what we're doing in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We as a country have voted to support a government in Ukraine that theoretically was elected by the people, but yet we're really supporting an uprising in a sense. So it seems like we're still battling that battle, like the old Cold War, you know.
Arena, do you?
I'm not familiar. I mean, from what you're describing of the LaRouche signs, I think I actually saw them, and I don't think that's related to whistleblowing or civil disobedience. I think that's just unhappiness with the, you know, results of an election.
No,
and the second issue was, but I don't know enough about the issue.
Seriously, go. I'm not a politician, nor am I an expert, nor am I a legal. I'm just a retired doctor who's very concerned about what's going on with our country.
I think my concern would be that anything that puts, you know, our president's face with a Hitler mustache would immediately lose credibility in my view, and so I have a hard time.
Sir, hang on,
yes.
We'll.
I just have a hard time taking issues seriously when they come in that kind of packaging. So,
that's okay. We'll go next question, please.
Are you aware of anything being done with regard to screening contractors and the government taking responsibility to beef up their own security and the morality and trustworthiness of the people they hire.
I think there have been measures taken. I don't know that the government is taking that over, but I think the whole notion of contracting Social Security out and the financial incentives are very problematic. So I think that's one of the issues that has come to light. You know, how do you pick people? And I think it's just extremely naive to think that once you're on the inside, you're a good guy. And this is how we're operating right now. And we had Director of National Intelligence Clapper saying in an article that I just read that we're operating on a trust basis, which sounds crazy given the kind of information that we're collecting. I mean, there have always been moles, there will always be moles, and I'm not talking about, you know, people trying to generate public conversation. So we need much better security screenings than that.
Okay, well, I want to thank everybody.
Oh, sorry.
Please.